This program is intended for a print impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, a program sponsored in part by the Lions Club of Rutland. And thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. It's Friday, June 12th. In the next half hour, we will be bringing you news from the Landmark. This is Paul Nato. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for supporting Audio Journal. Thank you. This first article this week is kind of near and dear to my heart. And it comes from Danielle Ray, Landmark correspondent. Residents voice concerns over e-bike safety. Residents in the region continue to express concern about youths riding electric bicycles dangerously, putting themselves and motorists and others in danger. E-bikes and the issue of safety surrounding the use of them has been topics of conversation for quite some time. Now, in May, Governor Maura Healey filed a bill being taken up by the Joint Committee on Transportation that would require annual registration and insurance for all motorized bicycles in Massachusetts. That was the same month a juvenile riding an electric scooter was seriously injured in a crash with a vehicle in Clinton. A number of social media posts have been made by locals about young people on e-bikes swerving in and out of traffic, disobeying road rules and laws, not wearing helmets, and more, along with photos and videos of specific incidents. A Sterling resident, who does wish to remain anonymous, recently posted videos on a community Facebook page of two young men riding e-bikes on Raleigh Hill Road neighborhood without helmets and not allowing the driver to pass them. Those kids were rude and probably going around 25 miles per hour, and they were weaving side to side on a road. The person shared they were all over the road, and then they gave me the finger when I tried to go around them. And unfortunately, the picture shows the kid giving the finger. Sterling Police Department Police Chief Sean Gaudette recently expressed that there are certain pros and cons when it comes to e-bikes and scooters. I think we all appreciate the sense of freedom a bike gives a kid, he said. Getting away from the house, meeting up with friends, and exploring the town can become an adventure. And it's almost like a rite of passage. It was for him. The concern with a lot of today's e-bikes is that from a safety standpoint, many are far closer to motorcycles than a traditional bicycle. Gaudette continued, you would never buy a child a 125cc dirt bike and tell them to ride it around downtown, yet some of the e-bikes currently being marketed online are that and more. They're capable of 30 to 45 plus miles per hour right out of the box. He went on to say that while it is difficult for most kids to pedal a traditional or a BMX bicycle at 20 miles an hour for any real length of time, e-bikes are in a whole different category. These bikes can reach those speeds almost instantly with very little effort, and the physics of a crash at 10 miles per hour. Oh, cool. Let's see here. At 10 miles an hour versus 40 miles an hour, there's a big difference there. So the result can be quite dramatically different. The potential for serious injury increases significantly. He said that law enforcement is also seeing a growing social media trend and influence around street takeover style riding culture involving bikes, motorcycles, and cars. Kids naturally imitate what they see online, often without fully understanding the consequences, Gaudette said. That can lead to riding in traffic, weaving between vehicles, ignoring traffic controls, or taking unnecessary risks for attention or for entertainment. He emphasized that the SPD's philosophy will always be education before enforcement. We encourage parents to understand the capabilities of the bikes, to have some conversations about safe and respectful riding, and to ensure kids understand that these are not toys, Gaudette said. Helmets, supervision, and getting the clear expectations can go a long way. In addition, he urges residents to contact their local police department if they are experiencing ongoing issues or safety concerns in specific areas. Now, community feedback helps them address problems early and to focus on education and prevention before someone does get seriously hurt, Gaudette said. When asked if e-bikes are allowed on rail trails in town in the area, the police chief said he did not see anything on the town website or an actual sign that does prohibit them. Google and MassBike seem to agree that class half 1/2 are allowed, Gaudette said, and shared that MassBike webpage that has e-bikes and frequently asked questions, safety questions. Now, Sterling Police Department Sergeant Ryan Ferguson and Lieutenant Steve Fugier also weighed in on the topic. Ferguson said that for the most part, the interactions he has had with the youth riding bicycles and e-bikes around town has been positive, with the kids being respectful, wearing helmets, and understanding the rules of the road. But, like anything else, there are always a few situations that raise concern and lead to complaints from residents. E-bikes are definitely becoming more popular around town, and for the most part, kids are out enjoying the nice weather and having fun with them, Ferguson said. That said, we have received complaints from residents about some riders traveling too fast, weaving through traffic, or not paying attention to cars and pedestrians. At the end of the day, our biggest concern is safety. A lot of these e-bikes can travel in excess of 25 miles per hour, and the kids sometimes forget they're not toys. And when they're riding near traffic, we just encourage riders to slow down, wear helmets, and use some common sense so nobody gets hurt. We're not looking to ruin anyone's fun. We just want everyone to stay safe. Fugier echoed Ferguson's sentiments, saying e-bikes have definitely become more popular around town, especially with younger riders. And overall, most of the interactions we've had have been positive. Fugier did admit that they have received some complaints related to speed and riders not always paying attention to the traffic or pedestrians. As always, safety is our main concern, he said. We're not looking to discourage the kids from enjoying them. We just want them and the riders and the drivers on our roads to stay safe. Rougier reported that the SPD is partnering with the Sterling Recreation Department to host a bike rodeo this summer focused on bicycle safety, safety riding fundamentals, and also, probably more importantly, rules of the road. The event is fully grant funded and will include the distribution of free bicycle helmets, bike lights, coloring books, and other safety materials for kids and families, he said, adding that they are in the planning process and people can reach out to him or the police recreation department or the recreation department for more details. My own experience, last night I was driving in the town I live in. There was a young boy, probably around maybe 12, 13, on an e-bike. He kept up with me while I was going 35 miles an hour, and he had no trouble doing it. So I understand what they're saying. And also, he didn't have a helmet on. And so just be careful. Obviously, you don't want to see anybody get killed or anybody's summer ruined because they fell. Well, you can't say I didn't try. We do have a budget story. Comes from Paxton. Comes from Ken Cleveland, then my correspondent. Paxton talks budget cuts and a possible override. Now, there's a special town meeting, and it's on June 22nd. Now, as the select board on May 26th discussed the town finances in the wake of the failed override, town administrator Robert Burbick said the town had gotten a new assessment from the schools using the anticipated Chapter 70 funds that they believe will receive at $160 per pupil. That resulted in a school reduction of $555,000 across the district. That has brought the town budget deficit down to $415,000. For the current year, another try at an override is possible as officials look at deeper cuts. So the timing is going to be tough, Select Board Chair Julie Pignatori said at the board's May 26th meeting. If the Finance Committee recommends an override and we do agree to go forward with it, another attempt to have at an override, we're going to be looking at having how that override vote within the next fiscal year, as long as it's before September, it can apply to this fiscal year. But I think we need to make sure that we're just being mindful and that the timing as we move forward. The Finance Committee started its work the following night. They started on May 27th. At that meeting, Burbick had some updated information about the costs that had risen. Keeping 24/7 police coverage, even with some cuts, would still require adding back at least $20,000. That news came as the Finance Committee discussed possible cuts, plus taking more from the ambulance fund. Now, the consensus among members of the two boards at that Finance Committee meeting was that a lower override number would be needed to make passage more likely after the $470,000 override proposal failed at the town election. Getting it under $400,000 wouldn't make it palatable, several said. Anything under $400,000 would be a win, Finance Committee member Kyle Ottman said. If there's a three at the top of the ballot item, he said, voters would see a reduction. It is a tough challenge, he said. They have to see what a balanced budget would be, suggesting that town meetings, they should show everything that would be cut, such as round-the-clock police coverage. And there was agreement that the numbers on the warrant and the ballot should match, noting that the confusion when the override number on the ballot had to be set before definitive numbers were available and with the reduced number presented at the town meetings. Pignatori said the board would be looking at several articles on the town meeting warrant to be discussed at the June 1st meeting. These would include rescinding the budget votes from the May town meeting, then putting budgets for the town and the school with one contingent on the override and one not contingent, which would reflect the deeper cuts. We're waiting for Rutland, and Rutland is waiting for us, Finance Committee Chair Mark Love said, reflecting the fact that the failure of the school budgets in towns forced the schools to reconsider their budget. That ended up with the school committee allocating $550,000 in state aid to lower town assessments, which cut Paxton's cost by $50,000. It appears none of this is set in stone, but we're looking at $336,000 number, possibly $416,000, Love said. Noting cuts would go deep, Love said, I hope we don't go there. It's definitely going to hurt, Burbick said. People don't like uncertainty, Love said. Overrides across the state are at an unprecedented level. because of the cut in state aid. He said, noting cuts to school aid were passed on to the towns, which created a double whammy. It said an override proposal needed widespread support. The $550,000 override last year passed because there was a concerted effort. We picked a number. We got to push that as the best we could, with several people commenting on inaccurate information being circulated in the public before the override, especially on the increased number for taxpayers. Burbick noted online tool homeowners could use to calculate the impact on their property tax bill once they entered the override amount. Love said the increase had averaged $373 a year for the $550,000 override. At 316, it will get below $300 per house. We need to do a better job of telling them what that number is, Love said. With the select board meeting June 1st and the finance committee meeting on June 3rd, both of which are after the Landmarks print deadline, the numbers from cuts to any override figure are still in flux. So until Rutland and Paxton kind of get together and get it going, I guess the school budget is still in flux. But hey, everybody, you're listening to Audio Journal. And this is the Community News, The Landmark, which is a production of Audio Journal. And thank you, as always, supporting Audio Journal. It's so important. Thank you. Little plug here. Every Tuesday is a Holden's Farmers Market. And it's going to be held from 3 to 6 p.m. Started in May. It's going to run till October. It's right across from the Gale Free Library. Now, there's going to be local fruits and veggies, bread and baked goods, meat and eggs, milk and cheese. You can get your wife some fresh cut flowers or somebody else, crafts and soaps, and much, much more. So once again, that's every Tuesday in Holden, right across from the library. If you want to just stop by and check it out, that's always fun to do. So once again, the Holden Farmers Market. Our next story comes from Ken Cleveland, Landmark correspondent, and the title is Almanac Market Brings Antiques and Artisan Items to Paxton. The Almanac Market opened a new season for a seasoned antique dealer. The antiques and vintage business came very naturally to me, and it was definitely inspired by my aunts, my mother, and my sister, said Sky Wellington, proprietor. That led to her to Paxton after a chance Facebook image of the Paxton barn that was for rent at 242 Pleasant Street. I thought, what's this? I ended up responding to an ad for a barn for rent. After a visit, she was sold on the potential. It took about 24 hours for me to come up with a business plan for the property owners, Wellington said, and she invested in a new business. I decided to rebrand this specific location in Paxton as Almanac Market because it has the farm vibe. Being in a barn in Almanac means new season. I didn't know that. The path to Paxton was a long and winding, but Wellington is now open for business as a group shop with a variety of vendors and items from antiques to crafts. When her aunt died, Wellington inherited the contents filling a historical mansion. Her small Amherst apartment could not contain it. So she started a business on eBay, she said. That business inspired her to buy at flea markets. When she was told you can't go to the flea market anymore, it looks like an antique shop in here, she said, well, if I open a store, can I go to another flea market then? Another aunt owned an antiques and consignment store in Maine, and her sister had a handcraft market in Groton. Her mother had found old furniture and decorated it. Mom did it back then because we couldn't afford to buy new things. She was really onto something. Now, Wellington opened in a old vintage place in Greenfield in 2018, selling but also renting as an incubator space for businesses. Her separate corporate sales and marketing chapter came to a close in 2023, and I decided to focus solely on my antique business. That later ended with her landlord's renovations running afoul of the building inspections closing the business. Uh-oh. She shifted to a location in Amherst, but she said the numbers were not working. In December of 2025, she closed that shop. One evening, as I was in the process of closing for good, I picked up my phone and Facebook showed me a picture of a barn. The barn was on Pleasant Street. It's now filled with items and vendors. I marketed heavily on my social media and the business social media pages, Wellington said. So she's getting the word out there. She connected with the vendors who are using space in the shop. At present, we have about a dozen vendors, and we're growing, she said, selling anything from antiques to collectibles, furniture art, and locally handmade crafts. Additionally, we have a clothing boutique specializing in vintage clothes. The vendors participate in the marketing as well. With a collective of vendors, we all participate in promoting the store. This is essential in spreading the word. My policy is that vendors have to post on social media a minimum of twice per week. This way, we are saturating the market and letting people know, everybody, that we exist. Other benefits of having the collective market is the community aspect of things, she said. I'm a very social person and feel very supported by the members of my vendor community. I'm very specific about who gets to have a space here, and I like to make sure that we all get along and we can work well together. Another benefit to having multiple vendors is that we now have a big variety of things because I don't like to buy things that some of my vendors buy. So it makes it more enjoyable for my customers to come in and shop a larger variety of items. The barn is just getting started with a lot of room to grow. I have room for vendors to rent a booth space or consign individual items at a time. We are also planning to open a thrift store in the upstairs half of the barn that used to be the nursery, Pleasant View Nursery office. In that section, I will be taking on donations or short-term consignment from the local community, Wellington said. Huh. Another thing that I've been talking about is a local brewery opening a tap room in the basement of the building, she said. So the whole thing's become a business as well as an attraction for the town. She has had a good response after the opening. The public has been tremendously supportive, and we already have a few local residents who are regular customers. I would also like to stress how amazing the town has been in this entire process. Tony Dominic, chair of the Economic Development Committee, and the select board member, Jeffrey Wenzel, hosted a ribbon cutting ceremony during the grand opening. The town has made itself accessible to me, so at any time I need something or I have a question, they've been readily available to help, Wellington said. What makes the shop special is that we're just normal people with hobbies. We're your neighbors and other members of the community looking for something fun to do. We bring out our joy of vintage, decorating, in a past memory into the barn, she said. She also shared the journeys of being in business. I like to stress that anyone can do this, so I make it a point to share my stories, which include celebrations as well as hardships in business, to normalize things for people. People can look like superhumans, but we're just regular people who didn't want to answer to a boss anymore. Being out in the open about being in business inspires people to do things in their lives that they would otherwise wouldn't have, because if she can do it, so can I mentality is a thing. I love to inspire people for economic and personal growth. Wellington wears a lot of hats in the business. I buy what comes in our consign with people who have items, which happens a lot in his business, she said. She also plans to put the power of donations to work for charity. We're planning to start a charitable program funded by a community donations of things we can resell. This is still in the planning phase, but my hope is to work with a local woman's philot to then disperse throughout the community, Wellington said. Antiques may be the anchor, but Wellington said there are many other things. Artisan vendors, in addition to vintage antiques, include things like hand-crocheted plants and imaginative creatures, hand-painted signs, handmade jewelry, pottery, greeting cards, lotions, soaps, and room sprays, to just name a few, Wellington said. A recent Facebook post listed Almanac Market's hours as 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., Thursday through Sunday, with some pop-up buys, some pop-up hours. So, talk about repurpose, huh? Taking an old barn and making it into what we hope is going to be a successful business. That'd be cool. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal. It's a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Now, archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or you can go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Paul Nadeau. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, if you got a big day this week, we're going to have some fun with it, right? Okay. And stay out of the heat. Man, it's been hot. Have a good one.
Juan Fernandez Islands off the coast of Chile are home to many unique birds. Perhaps the most vibrant is a critically endangered hummingbird called the Juan Fernandez Firecrown. The firecrown's lustrous feathers almost glow in the sunlight. The male's bodies are a fiery orange, and their crowns gleam in shades of cinnamon to golden yellow. Females wear cooler tones, with green backs, white bellies, and their own gorgeous crowns of shimmering blues and purples. Measuring more than 4 inches long from beak to tail, the Juan Fernandez firecrown is hefty for a hummingbird. To conserve energy while feeding, the birds often hang upside down on flowers, rather than hovering in place. But when courting an eligible female, the males still give it their all with an impressive flight display. Unfortunately, habitat loss and the spread of invasive species in the Juan Fernandez Islands threaten to extinguish the firecrown's brilliance. These hummingbirds are only found on Robinson Crusoe Island, where no more than a few thousand remain. Today, conservationists with Oikonos ecosystem knowledge are working to restore the island's native forests and to ensure a bright future for the Juan Fernandez firecrown. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.